good weekend. It's good to be back with you once again. I'm Henrik, and we welcome you to another Red Ice radio program. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com is our websites where you can find much more of what we do. Neil Kramer is a British philosopher and esotericist. His work focuses chiefly on spirituality, metaphysics, mysticism, freedom, and inner development. Well, he returns today to pick up on our last discussion that we had on tribal heritage. We are going to take the concept a bit further today and talk about how human rights, the promises of equality, the charge of discrimination, is something that leads to self-censorship, and it's actually used against us to get us under the global thumb of control and management. Mr. Kramer, welcome back. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for returning once again, Neil.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So how have you been? It's always good to have you back. It's always good to kind of touch base with you and see what you have going on. And as usual, Neil, you have a lot of irons in the fire, a lot of projects going. But how have you been?
Yeah, I've been very well, really good. I've been writing and filming and spending time with people and traveling and quality time and space with friends and family. So trying to strike a good balance. We all have our creative projects, but for me, I have to, just as with any normal job, make sure that there's a nice balance of time with people and time alone and time with loved ones, as well as my work and my creative endeavors. So yeah, really, really, really good. Thank you. And you're doing well in yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no shortage of things to do or be concerned with or fight for. And, you know, that's what we do here. It's more, I wish I could clone myself and you know, you could have a whole team of Henriks running around and, you know, be my little slaves or something like that.
I think they're already doing that in some laboratories, actually, aren't they?
Yes, I think so. I think you're right. Let's have it, shall we? Already, you know, bring it on so we can get some stuff done, right? No, but we have a couple of things lined up here today, Neil, that we want to get into. And I guess to a certain extent, it's kind of following on a little bit on the discussion that we had last time. You know, the world is just kind of, well, in my view, really just spinning out of control. There's so many things going on. There's so many things that are, you know, disheartening and concerning. But we got to try to remain our grounding and in all of this also, of course, remember, you know, who we are and what we're doing here and everything. And I think you're always very good in kind of bringing that out of us a little bit, if you will. You know?
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I do have this very implacable reliance and natural gravitation to the positive angle of this stuff, because I do see all of this treachery and all of this fragmentation ultimately as a teaching device, as a piece of theater that we've come right into the end of it, and it's at its peak, and things are rapidly disintegrating. But I see that as a very high-level metaphysical device to show us something very important. So I never really am in any danger of losing heart over this stuff. And I would say that, you know, if you consider any of the systemic problems that we have in the world today, like very poor misconceptions about race and sexuality and liberty and so on, which I know has demanded a lot of attention on your show, and some of which we're going to examine those issues today, they do all tend to come and spring from one very serious metaphysical decision that we each have to make. And that decision is this: do you want to go with the program, or do you want to go your own way? And I think we're all presented with this choice very early on in life, maybe around our early teenage years for the first time. Go with the program, right? Or go your own way. And then again, through life, we get to re-examine that. And the overwhelming majority of people go with the program, right? And the program is all the mainstream accepted culture and commerce and law and media and religion and society that all together is grouped as one and put forward as normality, right? Mm. And the schools and institutions and the governments and corporations, they all preach the program of normality. And we're led to believe early on that it's a big, free, open, democratic playground where you can get some good stuff if you work hard. And we come to know through our studies that this is an illusion, right? And that it's a program of normality. And there are a million choices within that program, different things you can do, but none of them are our choice. None of them can be our choice. They're off a menu, and they're all choices that suck the power from the individual. Okay, so my ultimate proposition, really, with all these things that we're going to dig into, is that your soul, in conjunction with the nature of this planet and the wider forces of the universe, wants you to go your own way. And that's the real mode of living that enlivens our will to grow, to know truth, to refine, to excel, to be strong, to create, to love, to destroy, all in the proper way. So going your own way awakens a very healthy appetite in the individual for discovery and heritage and connection and novelty. And it's a good way to live. It's unique. Only really able to be determined this kind of thing for ourselves over time. And it's only, I think, when we walk this very singular path that our identity emerges. Like I described it the other day, like a sculpture emerges from a block of granite that the sculptor slowly works at. And this is how we learn to know who and what we are, by walking this path of unique, custom-built selfhood. Our spiritual identity emerges, and it can only emerge from doing it your own way. And I would say that the universe supports this path and this method, and it lends its resources and wisdom to everyone who finds their own niche, their own, you know, plows their own furrow, discovers their own truth. That's the way you do it. Going with the program, on the other hand, if you do that, you give away your power and your choice, and you sort of trade it in for a safe, predictable, routine life. And the enticement and stimulus to go with the program is overwhelming from school onwards, really, everywhere in industry and at home and technology everywhere. Go with the program. Choose from their menu. They'll provide the jobs and houses and education that you want. And that's all they ever talk about: jobs, houses, education, healthcare.
Yep,
as if those are the only things in the whole spectrum of human spiritual evolution. You know, jobs and houses, right?
Yep.
That's the program of normality. What is generally considered as normal in the mainstream is an emanation of this program. And not all of it is bad, right? Some things can be good, some biology and science and literature or whatever, some creativity. There's some decent things in there. But it's the overall attitude and context and perspective of the program that delivers this normality. And its message is this: surrender to the collective. Give in. Regard yourself as a little node on a big network, and in fact quite low down on the hierarchy, and lucky to have your job and your house. And maybe if you work very, very hard, you might get some better stuff. And that's the program, right? And poor people of all races, but very often represented in large numbers of people from India and Africa and Mexico, they are the slaves of the program. Okay? It's not slaves to white people or Europeans or cops or big business, but to the program. The poor are the serfs, particularly to the Democratic Party of the wing, right?
Right.
They are the wage slaves and the voter slaves, and their masters might allow them to have an iPhone, but they also make damn sure that they live in continual, cyclical, financial and moral poverty. And in that state of deprivation, they will do what they're told. When they're told to riot, they will riot. When they're told to work, they'll work. They're programmed. Go to sleep, go to your job, have babies, get sick, spend money, give your power to us. And that's what the poor do. And again, it's everybody. It's all races. But if one sort of cultural subtype, which may be represented in an ethnicity, it may not, if they choose to overly rely on government for welfare or handouts, then they become very conditioned in their vulnerability. So the two go very closely together. So there we have two pathways. Go with the program, not good, or go your own way. Excellent. And there's a lovely phrase in Latin that champions this principle, which is this: vium invenium aut facium, which means find a way or make one, right?
Very good. Yeah, exactly. Neil, let me ask you, would you say as well that this is true? I mean, if we look at an individual, I think that path is true. But even for a people, I think it would be true as a larger version of that, where we can see that it's almost like, you know, do we go our own way? Do we find an essence of what we are, or are we lost in the bigger picture of this, you know, one size fits all that you're talking about? Because I think to a certain extent, if we, this is happening because we have let go of the spiritual essence of who we are. We are losing our way, and therefore we have these deconstructive things occurring. And ultimately, I believe, in a way, that's why people are, you know, losing their house or losing their job or can't hold on. These are the things that come out when things are unstable. Like if, you know, a tree falls in the forest, you have things going on to the tree immediately to try to break it down. It's dead and it's over, right?
Yeah, I think that they're very concerned, the administrators of the program, and I'll come to what I mean by that in a minute. They're very concerned that whatever you do, you choose from their menu. So at all costs, it must be one of their lifestyle choices. So, for example, being a new ager, which I know you and I are not very fond of that. If you're a new ager, that's a menu choice. It's not a spiritual path, the new age. It's a lifestyle choice. It's a fashion.
Yeah.
It keeps people constrained from growth and looking at the wrong things. So they can dress up in a certain way and talk about oneness and so on. But they're actually serving themselves up on a platter to be feasted upon by empire, right? And similarly, if you went to look at any cultural subgroup, like if it was people who devote themselves to a fundamentalist religion or people who devote themselves to a kind of music, goth or rap, or a kind of skater culture or juggalo culture or thug culture, those are not things that spring from people. Those are imperial menu choices that have been determined to have a certain effect of division. And so it's ironic that the diversity of their menu choices brings division.
Exactly.
That's the whole point. It's not things that come from people. So making your own path might be that you connect with your heritage, which again, I know you and I are very keen on that and always have been from the first time we talked, whatever, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
We've always been interested in our European roots and our ancestry. We've always been, but it's sometimes not encouraged that within empire, because it can be very empowering and it can give you a sense of strength and pride to see some of the extraordinary accomplishments that come from our ancestors, those in the historical record and those that are not, those that come through rather more esoteric means or ancestral spirits or vision quests or things that are off the menu entirely. And that's a worry to empire. And I think I said this last time, but let me just briefly explain. When I say empire, for those uncertain of its usage, empire is a shorthand that I use for the system that's set against the growth of man. It's the New World Order, the negative Illuminist groups, the fraternal societies, the industrial military complex, the demonic forces, whatever. It's those who dwell in shadow. And I have described empire as an ethos, a way of doing things more than a group, that seeks to limit humankind to a lower state of being. And at a very basic level, stupidity is good for business, you see. It makes governance easier. Yeah. So keeping people stupid is easy. It's good. At a higher level, which is what we ought to be looking at, the sort of pressurized low-frequency consciousness that restricting growth produces is a source of fuel for empire. Or if you want to be more romantic, a source of food, right?
Right.
So empire is a construct of control and management, and it's administrated through corporations and think tanks and schools and government and all sorts of things. And all the major nations must operate under its policies or they get invaded. and sequestered, Borg style, right?
Yep.
So it's important to understand what that is, because when you look at the origins of things, you need to sometimes reference this. So I would say that there are so many intertwined subjects for us to get into, especially with regards to individuality and freedom and equality and social justice and so on. And I think it's important to, for us to recognize, and this is where I put my philosopher hat on for a moment, that these things are part of our spiritual development. They're not separate from it, they're part of it. And if we can bring them into sharp focus, the puzzles and the quandaries do begin to answer themselves, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So part of the trick with this business, as you'll know full well, is deconstructing things, is taking what you think you know and pulling it to pieces with your screwdriver and putting all the pieces on the floor and saying, okay, so what is this thing? What actually is it? I thought I knew what it was, but what is it? So throughout our considerations in this conversation, I think it's good for us not just to map out the problems and solutions and sound bites and the real stories, but understand why these situations came about in the first place. So we do create solutions, thank goodness, but until we know why things like transpire in the first place, they just continue to recur like a wound that we have to dress over and over again. So what we want to do is stop inflicting that wound at all. And we do that, especially in mystical study, by ceasing to misconceive, right? So all the dread of empire is the result of misconception. We consciously make things happen in ourselves or unconsciously. And when we give our power away, it goes somewhere. It doesn't just disappear and evaporate. It goes somewhere. Something happens to it. So we know that there are negative forces that bring diminishment to humankind. But how is it that these forces came to be influential? Influential. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? You know, whether you think they're men or they're aliens or gods, you know, are we being punished? Why would the universe permit that to happen? Why does it have to be broken?
Right.
And what is our consensual role in that? So you see here the necessity for spiritual philosophy. Without that, you can't get anywhere, in my personal view. It's not good enough to protest and object, and it certainly doesn't help to get indignant and bang our fists on the table. If we want to do that, fine, we're allowed, but we can do better than that. So to go to the root of something, to genuinely comprehend something, you have to understand its foundation, its emergence, its genesis. You know, we can't know that by always attending to the branches and the leaves, as it were. We need to go to the hidden thing, the hidden roots, the bit we don't always see, you know, it's underground. So what is the nature of the seed that brings this into being, right? And you see the state of the media reporting at the moment with regard to these subjects. It's crazy, right? It's really crazy when you look at what's happening, particularly with race in the States at the moment. There's just been another one with Baltimore. I would say, as part of our deconstruction today, if you did a strict interpretation of the ridiculous incitement to racial hatred law, the whole media industry would now be in jail.
Yeah.
If you turn that rancid policy back on themselves, they'd all be in the slammer because they are inciting racial misconceptions.
Yep.
You know, people haven't just suddenly started wanting race wars or gender wars or migrant wars or political wars. These things have been yanked to the top of the headlines for a reason. And I think when we look at it, it becomes clear that you have to have a real delicate blend of courage and insight if you want to know what this happens, why this happens. If you just go by what you think you know, or if you allow yourself to get triggered, you don't see it. So we must not be afraid. And again, I'm not speaking to you personally. I know you don't have any trouble with this, but we must not be afraid to make judgment calls, to judge and distinguish things we see in the world that are wrong and things that are right.
Exactly. Yeah.
We must not be afraid to make judgments. That's what humans do. Anything and everything that we deem genuinely substantial deserves judgment. It deserves a consideration and an observation. Because if we don't exercise that will, we feed empire. We give it to empire. So disavowed will is the staple diet of empire. And all those millions of apathetic morons out there chanting things like they've been fed dog biscuits, you know, it doesn't help. So let us not be among them, me and you and the listeners. We have a good chance of not having any problem with that. So as we said, thinking about race, ethnicity, different cultures, gender, sexual orientation, I think it's fair to say that for many people, it really is genuinely difficult to talk about some of those things, especially race and sexuality, without triggering all sorts of responses and conditioned memes.
Yep.
Right? It's very hard. You can't walk into a restaurant and start talking to strangers about that. And even we in our more enlightened circles still have to be careful.
That's what makes it so interesting too, Neil. I got to keep that in mind. I mean, what is it with those things that are so you know, delicate and that alone makes it a question worthy to examine, you know?
Exactly. And as my grandfather says, you know, it's a shame that we have to whisper about these things across the kitchen table.
Yeah.
And that's again, planned, right? So I often say we have to suspend our triggers for a minute, however few or many we have, our emotional triggers, in order for us to determine what is actually going on here, to see the truth, which benefits all of us, wherever we are. And if I may say, you and I, Henrik, have a bit of extra responsibility with our platforms to do better than normal and have more skill and wisdom than normal, because there's a lot of people who respect our views and ideas and look to us to see how we do it. Not necessarily because that's the way they're going to do it, but how do we do it? Because we're good guys. How do we do it? So we can't just say shit. We have to construct our argument, choose our words, which gladly, as I say, I don't think you and I have had or will have any trouble doing. But I just want to register that, because if there are people from some of the minorities and groups and stuff, you ought never to be worried about that, because the only people who ever make us feel uncomfortable is empire, not ourselves. It's empire.
Right.
So I think a very important principle is to acknowledge that, first of all, things are not what they appear to be when you look at the news headlines, even the simplest stories. They don't really represent reality. And it can be hard to believe that, just how staggeringly delusional the media is. Because it's hard to believe, because they've been doing it for a very long time, a very long time.
Yeah.
So let's start with this, if I may. The conventional interpretations of equality, rights, sexual orientation, and racism are grossly misleading. Or if you want to put it simply, they're just wrong. And I would say that they are almost the opposite of what they purport to be, of what they represent. So, for example, in the same manner that an individual might wonder at first, a normal, decent human being, why are there so many wars around the world? Is invading and bombing and butchery still the best we can do in the 21st century?
Yeah.
Why are we in Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Syria, Pakistan? Why? Why are we blowing people up? Because it's not about freedom. I think we know that. It's not about bringing democracy. Well, if you examine the root of that, you come to the rather unpalatable conclusion that this thing, empire, requires permanent war to fuel its economy, both in its socialist and capitalist wings, in its Republican and Democrat wings. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Empire, especially in Europe and America, needs war to function. So armed conflict provides guaranteed opportunities for resetting social norms periodically, for garnering nationalistic support, instilling fear, and desensitizing people to slavery, right? So the third world make stuff that we use, and if there's any hiccups, we kill them. So war occurs not because of the things that CNN and BBC tell us or the Washington Post or The Guardian or The Telegraph, but because war is central to the fundamental ideology of empire, of our culture. And it has been executed just like this since at least Rome, which we can see clearly. And if you really want to push it, maybe back even earlier than the first pharaohs of Egypt. The same thing, the same empire. It's the same crew, the same firm, right? So that's very different from the sort of children's fables in the history books and in your politics class at university. Very different. So if we move that same principle to race and sexuality, it starts to open up. And race and sexuality in particular are very closely aligned in terms of their usage by empire. And if we look carefully and put our detective hat on, so we've removed our philosophical hat, and we're now putting our detective hat on. We need many hats, you see. When we put that on, this race and sexuality thing does give us clues about what empire's up to if we look carefully and if we don't allow ourselves to be emotionally triggered. There is a time to be compassionate and fiery and stout-hearted or whatever, but it's good if we can exercise control over that, the timing of that too, when the moment's right. You know, we don't want to be weeping over poetry while we're robbing a bank, do we? Right? So you want to control what you're doing. So if we let's zoom right in and take example of a headline that's in vogue at the moment, right? And let's consider these headlines as general templates or formulas for numerous headlines, because the details change, right? But the headline formula on your screen and on your page stays the same. That's the bit that matters. So here's an example formula, something you might see, right? Disgruntled black people in wherever, Baltimore, Missouri, New York, protest, riot, and take legal actions against unjust treatment, right? That's a headline that's been very, very vivid and aggressively pushed for a good while now, for the last year. Another headline, and notice the similarity, disgruntled gay and transgender people protest and take legal actions against unjust treatment, you know, because something happened at school or yep. They want to get married or they're disputing their photograph on an ID card or they want to buy a cake or something. Those headlines are obviously something that I've worded, but that's the formula.
Sure.
That's the formula that they put forward. So these are memes, right? These are idea viruses. And a meme is a behavioral kind of instruction that's passed on through repetition and then imitation, right? So people take legal actions or protest or riot because of the memes, not because they want to, but because of the memes. And that's an important point. So I suggest to you that the purpose of these headline formulas is to invoke division and polarization.
Of course.
In that, you will either endorse them or reject them. You'll either think, hell yeah, or hell no, right? It's a polarizing effect, and that sets the tribes against each other, the whites, the blacks, the Asians, the Europeans, the educated, the uneducated, and it works. The straights against the puffs, the independents, the collectivists, whatever, the rebels, you know, the conformists, all wrong answers, right? They're all wrong answers. So the upshot of that is, otherwise, you know, normally decent-minded people who have the potential for excellence and accomplishment in their own lives are getting conditioned to either radicalize or shut the mouth. So empire wants you either as a loud-mouthed, vulgar extremist, of which we see images of that every day on the news, or a silent, impotent generalist. And again, both wrong answers. You can't win. You're not meant to. The house wins every time. Thank you very much. And that's the sting. Empire has constructed a clever system of producing two false pathways and making many people believe that those are the only ways forward. You can either be a belligerent moron or a gentlemanly bystander. And both are wrong. Both are untrue. So that's a key consideration, that when you look at the headlines, it's presenting you with an impossible, unsolvable situation on purpose. So when you see decent people, perhaps like your mothers and fathers and aunties and uncles, going, oh, I don't know what's going on with the world. You know, it's such a mess. Oh, I just don't understand it. They're not meant to. It's meant to create division and despondency. That's the purpose of the news, not to tell you what's occurring, but to create that problem.
Of course, yeah.
So what we have to do is deconstruct that every single day. And once you've been doing it for a while, you don't have to try anymore. It's easy. It's not exhausting like it used to be when we first started doing this. It's easy, right? When you do see people who are exhausted by it, you have to give them a break. Because when you first start to see this problem in the world, it is exhausting and it's very disenchanting. So you have to give people a break and just let them go at their own speed, even though it might be frustrating from time to time. But if we take one of those examples, equality, should we speak about that for a moment?
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Because equality seems pretty clear cut to most people. And it's one of the vital elements for me in understanding empire's current modality, what it's doing right now with regard to freedom of expression, freedom of thought. Equality, I would say, is a very modern concept, like social media, ubiquitous but unneeded, right? The root of equality as an apparently moral aspiration, which seems very fair and reasonable, doesn't it, goes back only to the 1940s, right? Shortly after the end of the Second World War, when empire had a lovely opportunity to pin down lots of things because it lost one battle, but there was a big war still on. So Germany had been doing some very weird things that scared the shit out of empire. And so empire needed to make some very tight ideological changes to their global apparatus. And at that time, due to the global reset, they had a lovely sort of free hand to do all sorts of things. And in 1946, the Commission on Human Rights was set up by the United Nations Economic and Social Council with the job of creating an ideological charter for something called human rights.
With right? Eleanor Roosevelt was in right. charge of that, and FDR.
Oh, you know about this, don't you? I don't need to tell you about this, yeah. Which it would then go on, and again, you think, well, that sounds great. That sounds like it's going to make things better.
Well, that's just it. It's rhetoric versus real action.
Right,
but it sounds good. How can you be against
human rights? You know? That sounds smashing, you know. Which it would take this human rights thing and try and make it normal. So it had 50 years to make that normal. And then go around the world monitoring and policing it in alliance with, you know, what they might regard as global partners, the major nations of the world. So this is where the hideousness of delusional race and gender politics began. Its roots go prior to that, to left-wing manifestations in the 1930s. Very clever, very insidious.
I'd say almost, I know some have, I don't know if you would agree with that, but French Revolution times, either the Freemasonic kind of environment, a lot of people have pinned it back.
Absolutely. If you want to take groups of men sat in rooms creating strategies, you can go back a lot, hundreds of years on this. But if you want the clearest, well-documented manifestation, I would say from the 1930s to 1946, there's a very clear trail.
I agree.
And once you uncover that, I agree. You can go back and say, you know what? There were whispers about this going maybe 200-300 years prior to that as well. Yes, there were. But if you want a good starting point, is to take it from 1930 to 1946 is where we really see it, right?
Yeah.
So, again, we're faced with something that isn't what it appears to be. Human rights, very clever, you know, very clever saying that. It's not what it appears to be, right? And it's very challenging, really, really challenging that to people. Like some people think that a disaffected young man called Adam Lanza walked into Sandy Hook School and shot a load of kids. That didn't happen, right? Spend 1 week of your life analyzing that incident and you come away realizing that that didn't happen. Or it's like a mafia, right? The mafia have a delicatessen shop, a store that sells lovely meats and cheeses and breads and olives, right? And all that. But it's a front. It's a front for something different. It's a front for money laundering or drug smuggling or prostitution or tax evasion or something. In the same exact way, right, the UN is a front. Just like those other things, it's a front for imperial social administration and enforcement. And its real job is to bring all the major nations into the fold of one empire, into its giant propaganda machine. What the UN is not, what the United Nations is not, is lots of nice countries getting together to try and make the world a better place. That's it. It doesn't do that at all. It does the reverse of that.
Yeah.
So the Commission on Human Rights published this thing 2 years later, from 46, 48, 49 or something, called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in Paris. And it presents to us 30 so-called articles that appear to champion freedom and well-being for all of us, for me, you, and everyone else. What it's really for, and what it's been doing a very nice job of accomplishing in the 60-odd years since that time, is to condition people to this concept, and here's the punchline, of sameness. S-A-M-E-N-E-S-S. Sameness. Uniformity. Standardization, right?
Yep.
The end of any distinction between one thing and another, especially people, between one race, one culture, and another. Between, it's like saying a giraffe is the same as a lobster. They want us to believe that.
Pretty much, yeah.
And 100 years ago, you said, don't be stupid. Now people are like, well, I guess they are in a way. Right? We're asked to believe that they are the same. They might look a bit different, but they're the same. And this is the root of our misconception of equality. So if you take, we won't take 30 of them, or we'll be here till next week. But if we just take the very first thing it says, the first article in that Declaration of Human Rights, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. That sounds okay, doesn't it? That sounds smashing.
If you know what it really means.
No, I know, but sounds okay, doesn't it? If you said that to the guy who sells you, you know, your bottle of water in the store, he'd say, that sounds great. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. No, they are not. No. Not true. Philosophically not true. Politically not true. Practically not true. Human beings are not born free or equal in any way, shape, or form. I'm telling you that today. Neil Cramer's best advice. Human beings are not born free or equal. Certainly not in dignity. Dignity is created and refined by oneself over many years or even lifetimes of moral growth. And quite frankly, some people who are new souls, we'll say, being esoteric for a minute, and have very little attainment yet, very, very poor conduct, no honor, because they've not established those things yet, they don't have much dignity because they haven't made it yet. The potential is there, yeah. The capacity for these qualities exists, but it isn't formed. It isn't whole. It's not a guarantee. You can't pick it off a shelf or have somebody dish it out to you at the institute, right?
So it's saying basically you don't have to try harder because you're already number one.
It's saying you don't have to do anything. You are equal. You're already fantastic. You're already amazing. You don't have to do anything else. Okay? So that word rights as well, free and equal in dignity and rights. Rights. Rights.
I've been fascinated by that word, by the way.
They sound good. Meaning. Rights, don't they?
Yeah.
Yes, I beg your pardon. I've also thought, what is that? Because I've swung, I shall say, quite freely between thinking, yes, I have rights. No, I don't have rights. Yes, I have some rights. Well, I don't know. Now I have come to the conclusion, this is what I think about rights. Nature does not require rights.
There isn't such a thing.
There's no such thing as rights for anything or anyone. There never has been and there never will be, thank God. We are here. We might draw breath and we might not. End of story. There are no rights. The idea that certain arbitrary standards are being devised by the United Nations on behalf of the world population is utterly ridiculous. And as you say, Henrik, very wisely, the word right derives from the Latin rectus, straight, and that from the Proto-Germanic rechtas, right, straight. And if you look at the prior to that, the PIE, Proto-Indo-European, which I think you probably know what that means, yeah. Reg means to rule, to lead, to make straight.
Mm. Yep. Yep.
So that's worth noting, isn't it?
Very interesting.
So the UN has taught our kids for 50 years now that rights are an important thing, an important part of life. So anyone under the age of 50 who grew up in any vaguely civilized part of the world, and I use that word very loosely,
sure.
has been subjected to very invasive programming to believe they have rights.
Yep, right. You're right.
So,
yep.
So that's not true. You don't have any rights. You don't need them, right? You make your own stuff. You refine your own excellence and morality and being and conduct. And let's just finish that exercise. Let's take the second half of that sentence. This is just the first article in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Again, to the uninitiated, think that sounds nice. That sounds just lovely, peachy. Let's all do that. Well, I don't know about you, but the level of reason that people are endowed with is wildly different from one person to another, from one culture and tribe to another, from one man to one woman to one child. And I'm thinking, again, I'll be honest with you, that some of that is hardwired. There are many people I've met in the world who, though nice, would require decades of drumming stuff into their heads before they could exercise any sort of insightful, fluid reason.
Right.
And most of them don't even want to. They have no interest in that at all. Mm. I'm saying some of them can't do it even if they wanted to, because they're not there yet. And if you want to be spiritual about that, in their grand life cycle of 60,000 years, they're not at a point where there's any reason or conscience necessary. Conscience? Goodness me, conscience is a luxury in mainstream society. let's be generous and say that half the population don't give a damn about anything that doesn't benefit they themselves. Half the population are selfish and disconnected. For whatever reason, right? How that's come about, we'll worry about later, but for whatever reason, their conscience is very faint indeed.
Right.
So again, no, I reject that. The brotherhood element is a laugh as well. Spiritual brotherhood that I've sought in my life took me 30 years to find. It did not exist in many parts of my homeland in any noticeable quantity. I had to travel all over England and Europe and America to find it. I did find it, and it is everywhere. And now I've found spiritual brotherhood in good quantity and quality. I'm happy, and I realize that that's been an important part of my journey. But I could easily, had I been lulled into the lies of mainstream culture, gone my whole life and never had a glimmer of this spirit of brotherhood. And I know people who never see it or feel it. Most people, I would say, never see it or feel it. They read about it. They see it in movies, this great, intimate, spiritual kinship. And they see bits of it here and there in the family gatherings or whatever. But that's not it. That's not living it and sharing it and having it course through your veins with other high-caliber men and women. So that whole first article of the Declaration of Human Rights is shite. Honestly, it really is nonsense.
Yeah, I agree.
And there's another 29. You can go and have a look at those and make your own decisions. It looks like human beings trying to make a better world. But hand on heart, as me, myself, a self-appointed philosopher, a seer of truth to the best of my ability, there are no human rights on this planet. And the UN is the least capable of all bodies to articulate them, even if there were any.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a very important thing to understand. When you see the word equality, the word rights, the words United Nations, they're not what you think they are.
Yeah, I mean, we should be really worried about those who are claiming that they can hand us these precious items. You know, not all of them are, but some of them are, or that they are even in a position to issue so-called spiritual brotherhood from a piece of paper. You know, it's ridiculous.
It is. It's very concerning, because once you start to deconstruct it and see what it is, you know, rights to equal treatment are generally thought of, you know, in social terms, aren't they, with regard to status and opportunity, right? Now, that is very damaging if you clearly and carefully look at it. Metaphysically, from my understanding at least, you make and cultivate your own status and opportunities over thousands of years, partially through your ancestors, partially through yourself, partially through soul. So there's this important embodiment of soul, land, spirit, self, divinity. That's what brings opportunity and life circumstances to you. What you have learned about how your consciousness sculpts reality and how your soul communication advances your moral and emotional being. These things determine your status, nothing else, right? Not as a universal absolute forever, perhaps, but certainly now in this epoch that we're in this third density, expression of this planet, yes, that's how it is at the moment. So over many centuries, that the outside, seemingly external and random life situations are in fact brought about by ourselves through our attitude, our bearing, right? Interesting word, and our deeds. And to think that these can be dished out by government to everyone equally is not only foolish, as we say, but it's violently diminishing, which is what it's meant to do. So to think that we're the same is a worse error than you think it is.
Exactly. And even from the point of view of, let's say the more liberal minded, what have you, who thinks this sounds great and whatnot, just think about the people who issued this and even their possibility that they are somehow to understand, sure. Okay. Granted, not every nation has signed this declaration. So, okay, you have that element to it, but I bet you that their goal is to bring it to the entire globe. Right. But just that they have this attitude that they somehow can know or understand, exactly. Or know or understand a remote tribe in the Amazon or, the Sami people up, whatever, it's like, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous and it's damaging. So yeah. we have to maintain a sense of humor and perspective on it to say, it's not going to stick that. They're trying it on. It will fail and Earth will find its balance and its population and so on. There is no equality on Earth. There's no rights, there's no equality because it's unnecessary. Nature doesn't waste energy on unnecessary stuff. It doesn't need equality. It's surplus to requirements.
Those are true social constructs if you want to talk about any.
They are, thank you, yeah. And you live, you refine yourself and shape your life situation by the nature of your being. And there are no rights or equality anywhere in that equation. And what Empire is really doing with the dogma of equality is making critical thinking socially unacceptable, discrediting individuality, and making us believe that we're all the same. And the entire purpose of individualization from a philosophical point of view here on this planet is to give us the experience of selfhood, to give us free will to build and earn and cultivate excellence in ourselves, to foster good conduct, to form moral character over the years, to walk pathways of spiritual development and study and experiment, to ascend through this wonderful school of life. Everything is on merit. The pathways are unequal by design.
Yeah, and I mean, it's designed, I think, to ultimately also shut us down. You kind of talked about this already a little bit. It's on a, let's say on a legal basis, it's there to be able to penalize us if we violate these terms. And I'm not now talking about, the subject of, subjecting another to violence for say, but let's say words or thoughts even, or as you say, at some point, if you are critically thinking, this is something that might be able to be used against you at the end of it. And that's very worrying to me.
It is. And that brings this other key word of discrimination, which is you can't not like stuff anymore, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
You can't not dislike. You can't like, you can't dislike, you can't talk about it. The word discrimination, up until the middle 18th century, the primary meaning of discrimination meant it was an act of making or observing a difference, a distinction. such as discriminating between right and wrong. It was a good thing. Today, in 2015, the primary meaning of the word discrimination is unfairly treating a person or group.
It's amazing how that changed.
They've changed the use of the word discrimination. So here's a good little radical tactic you can do. Start using discriminate in a good way in your own language with your friends and family. Use the word discriminate, right? So unfairness has no part in the word discrimination. That's a social, political, ideological construct. It's an installation, right? So anti-discrimination laws are not to protect people from unfair treatment. They are solely to coerce consent and silence dissent. They make people feel they can't disapprove of something.
Exactly. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, I think someone else pointed it out, but it was the reality of the fact that you make choices in the morning. Someone said, "You guess what? You know, you discriminate against other shirts in your closet by not picking them in the morning." You know, it's just the reality of it. And this now is now somehow seen as a violent act. You know.
Yeah, and here in the States, as you know, various places, various different states here, like Oregon and California, Washington. In Oregon, people are losing their jobs and livelihoods and going bankrupt because they don't want to deal with certain people, right? They don't want to give them a cake for a homosexual wedding. Fine.
Was that in Oregon, by the way?
That was in Oregon, yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
That might be wise. That might be unwise, right? Depending on your perceptions. But it's a valid thing to do, in my book. If you don't want to do something, you shouldn't have to do it.
Let me mention something quickly about that, because I thought that was interesting. Let's see, I pulled out that the lawyer, I think it was, or whoever represented them, acting for the bakery, said, Lee was one of the guys here involved. But anyway, he said, if Lee's argument was right, a Muslim printer could not turn down a contract to print leaflets about the Prophet Muhammad. An atheist could not turn down an order saying God made the world, and a Roman Catholic printer could not decide making leaflets calling for the legislation of abortion on demand. I extended it further and said, how about going to a Jewish carpenter and force him to carve a swastika or something like that? I mean, it's ridiculous, right?
It is ridiculous. Let's say, for example, I didn't want to do business with people from Easter Island, right? I felt through my own experiences that Easter Island people are a bloody nuisance and I don't like them. I don't really want anything to do with them. Is that okay? Well, of course it's okay. I'm allowed to not like something. Should I be prevented from saying that? No. Should I be prevented from doing business however I want? No. And as soon as there's an interruption in any part of that chain, you've got a big problem, right? So however foolish and offensive it might be, it's still my private business, right? Now, if I go out of business because everyone loves Easter Islanders and they think I'm a ludicrous old xenophobe, then that's my problem. I've brought that on myself.
Of course, exactly.
That's fine. I don't care. That's fine. Yep. So if I run a bar, say, let's say my business was a bar in the city, a fun bar with whiskey and wines and beers and conversation and pool tables and whatnot. If I ran a bar, that might not be a good line of business if I am a xenophobic, bigoted, puritanical zealot, right? Because my likes and dislikes, my natural biases, which are my business, would be constantly stressed by all the strangers walking into my bar. So I couldn't have a sign outside saying no Eastern Islanders, no blacks, no Asians, no British, no liberals, no women, no ginger-haired people, no Man City fans, no drag queens, everyone else welcome. You know, you might not do that. You might go into you might sell paperclips instead. That might be a better type of work. If I am old-fashioned and I'm not sure about gay blokes kissing each other on the street, is it wrong for me to find that unpleasant? No. It might be old-fashioned, it might be culturally outdated, but it's still legitimate to express yourself deriving from how you feel and think, right? To have that expression curbed somehow opens up a pathway to have the feelings and thoughts themselves controlled, which is a disaster. Yeah. It's the opposite of a spiritually true life. So the moral observation here is that old favorite that you might not like it, but we should all be free to see it in the world from somebody's heart or pen or mouth or on a sign, whatever. You can't say to people, you must do this. You cannot say that.
Yeah, I mean, the big question here is where this will lead. What's the next step in the process? When the barriers of being offended, for example, moves into a tighter restricted zone, what happens then? And how is this going to redefine human relationships where you no longer have freedom of association? You're actually forced into situations. I mean, my God, talk about a contrived, weird, strange world. And I think that's the goal ultimately too, you know?
Well, will and individuality are very important parts of my life. And individuality is supreme. And that always comes first because I believe it is the entitization of a soul as an individual is the most beautiful and extraordinary spiritual teaching mechanism. Will is our free will is very important with regard to that. They're very closely related. Empire knows this. And so its primary objective at the moment to me seems to be to stamp out individuality, to make it uncool, right? And eventually sort of illegitimate. So this is where we see this determination to boost the idea of the group over the individual, which I know is a theme in your work. The illusion of this mass of commonly bonded people who freely generate normal patterns of behavior and morals and customs. No, it's an illusion. No such group exists in the mainstream. Normality is a collectivist instrument. It makes people afraid of doing their own thing, of leaving the program and going their own way. For me, the people I have the pleasure and privilege to work with are extraordinary individuals, and there's a clear pattern that the more they've embraced their individuality, the happier and more fulfilled and stronger they are. And as soon as you become yourself, which emerges over years, you don't just find it one day under a bush. As soon as you become yourself, which is an ongoing art project, you become completely uncontrollable. And empire loses another little node on the network. So the most sort of radical thing you can do is live your own life, create your own job, create your own sort of dynamic, have your own preferred kinds of relationships, do everything your way, and not choose anything really from the menu of the program because you don't need it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's take a short break here, Neil, and then we can pick up and talk more about this. But there are a couple of things sure. I wanted to talk a little bit about here. You have a workshop coming up. You have an awesome trailer out, by the way, too, that I want you to mention and give out the website where people can go to find out more about the new film here.
Sure, yeah. My annual workshop, which is really a fantastic opportunity for serious, high-quality people to come together and communicate and talk and listen and learn and speak, is going to be in August, August the 14th to August the 16th, over at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck in New York. Beautiful 200-acre campus in the countryside, lakes and woods and forests and all sorts. It's a fantastic place. Great speakers they have there, all kinds of mystics and Sufis and philosophers over the years. Very, very interesting thing. So you can go to neilkramer.com. It's called Knowing the Mystery. So I would love to see some of you guys there. I invite you to come along and spend a weekend with me and some other amazing people. And I guarantee you'll enjoy yourself. And yes, thank you. The trailer is for a forthcoming film that I'm working on with my colleague Niles Heckman. The film is called Transmutation, and you can go and check that out at transmutationmovie.com, and you can watch the trailer. And it's a film about uprooting the experience of normality. So it couldn't be more pertinent to what we're talking about today, and it's a very beautiful film, if I don't say so myself, largely due to the exceptional care and attention we've taken to getting the images right, the words right, the philosophy right. So we're trying to make it a piece of art, not just a message, but actually a piece of art that can be enjoyed and that will inspire us to go our own way.
All right, very good. We'll have the links up here, neilkramer.com and transmutationmovie.com. Do you have a couple other things like Alchemy of Will and a couple other things out there? So just tell us about those.
Absolutely, yeah, thank you. My latest workshop recording from last year, Esoteric Roots. You can download that. You can download Alchemy of Will, another workshop. You can download Unfoldment, Secrets and Sinks. You can download the Audio Cleaver. These are all works that I've been formulating over the last 10 years that constitute my central philosophies and principles and methods and techniques. And so it's really like several hours of teaching and learning, which is enjoyable, hopefully, funny at times, inspiring. And you can see all that on the website. So the latest one is called Esoteric Roots, which many people have told me how it's been the best one yet. So take a look at that. Again, if you go to neilcramer.com and click on the right-hand side, you'll see Knowing the Mystery, Esoteric Roots, Alchemy of Will, and all these other things. So please, please take a look. I think you'll enjoy them.
Very good. Take a peek, folks. We'll have the link up. As I said, we'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back with more. Stay with us. In the second hour, we continue to discuss human rights, equality, and discrimination, and how this leads to, and is intended to lead to, self-censorship. This is all part of a larger structure that has been designed to subjugate us, to entrap us under the global thumb of control, and ultimately disarm us, and preventing us from mounting resistance against a system that is all about turning us into a homogenized blob, more easily controlled, turn us into consumers without any anchoring to our past or any kind of deeper meaning whatsoever. So a very important hour is coming up here. Don't miss it. We proceed as we do at redicemembers.com. You can go there to sign up for a membership. And with a subscription, you get full access to our entire members website, where we have videos, TV episodes, Red Ice Insight, and also about 1,000 programs, radio shows, on many topics of interest that we have been looking into over the past 9 years. We do 3 programs a week. First hour always free, sometimes both. When we do the second, those are available to our members, and you can find our upcoming guests listed in our radio archive. But folks, stay with us. We'll be right back with more after this break.